If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
It is such a pleasure to welcome Dick Biondi to WGN. Dick, thank you for joining us, my friend.
Thank you, and thanks, Johnny. It's a pleasure to be here. I've dreamed about being on this station because it's the only major station in the city I have never been on.
Oh, yes!
And Dick brought this checklist. Okay, so you're checking that out.
That is so great.
No, that particular opening is the first time, and Ray Stevens was the A&R man and produced it down in Nashville.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great album. Well, it's fun. I love this.
It's really a slice of in fact, we listened to it over the weekend. I'd never heard it from beginning to end. And I got kind of teary because it's, you know, from a simpler time. And there's just a sweetness about it, Dick. It really is.
Thank you. It was a fun thing to do. And one of the nicest things about it, Ray was so nice in getting us together. Mm-hmm. And we were down there, and one of the things that really fascinated me while we were waiting to go to the studio to record it, we were in a motel and we were out on the balcony, and all of a sudden here comes the sirens, and we said, what in the world is this? And right down below us, probably not from here to the wall behind the Steve, is John Kennedy in a convertible going by.
And wow.
Sort of just a great feeling.
Yeah.
Sort of pepped everybody up.
Yeah, right. Now, when we say Ray Stevens, of course, we mean the famous singer-songwriter Ray Stevens, who's written some beautiful songs and then some not so beautiful songs like Ned Nostril and some of those classics, you know.
Our Butch Bavarian Beer.
Yeah. But when you went down to Nashville, because you were on a station that was heard around the country, I mean, people knew you all over the country as a disc jockey, right?
Yeah, we were. I believe we covered well,
yeah.
as Aubrey told in Cheyenne, Wyoming, they listen every. But we covered 44, 45 states very well, and all of Canada.
And you were on in the evening, so they could really hear you booming out there. Because the email we've got, you'll just love the email we have from people. I was in the service in El Paso, Texas, and I'd prop my transistor radio up against the barrack wall so I could hear Dick Biondi. These emails are so sweet, and people are just so thrilled to hear you on the radio.
Thank you. Thank you. That's the one thing, after all the hundreds or thousands of disc jockeys that have gone through Chicago and the major cities, when people remember one guy like this, it sort of makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up a little.
Now, home for you is, you were born and raised where?
Upstate New York.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I knew you were an East Coast kid. I didn't know you were upstate New York.
Yeah. A little town called Endicott, where IBM was founded.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And Endicott Johnson Shoes, which employed 99% of the Italian population in my hometown.
Oh.
And it was just a wonderful time. It's still there, the Triple Cities. I started in radio at the age of 8 in Auburn, New York.
8?
8.
Were you shaving yet? I mean, were you old for your age?
I was up there for the summer with my grandmother and grandfather, so I would run around and I'd go up to the Metcalf building.
Uh-huh.
There was a radio station there, and I went up one day and stood and was fascinated watching the guys, and I went back every day. And one day, Bob Morgan called me in, and he said, you really like this, huh? And I said, yeah. I was,
Wow.
And he said, can you read? And I said, yeah. He handed me a commercial for Brotan's women's clothing, and he said, read that. And I read it on the air.
At 8.
And that was it. I was hooked.
Oh. Well, who were you listening to as a kid, though, on the radio at that time? And were you, in fact, listening, saying, I bet someday I could do that, or was it reading that first commercial that did it for you?
Well, that did it, but I was listening to Jack Armstrong, The All-American Kid, Let's Pretend, Ted Mack's Amateur Hour, all of those great shows.
Uh-huh.
What was the point? I mean, you did that as a kid, but was there a point when you said, okay, this is really what I want to do for a living? Was it when you got into high school or after that, or how did that all happen?
It started even before, because in the eighth grade, I was working at WINR in Binghamton. When I was working, I was getting paid, running for coffee and hamburgers and spotting football for Bob Cullings, the man that taught me how to say words. because at that point I could not say the word three or four. Everything was like tree or fur. And, and every time I said something and didn't do it right, he'd kick me in the shins. Not hard, but... And he was just a wonderful man. And I was lucky enough to be with some great, great guys, including Rod Serling, who was started there. And
In the Twilight Zone,
yeah,
Rod Serling.
And he would always give me like a dime or 15 cents for bringing him a hamburger or coffee from Michelangelo's restaurant was where they'd send me.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and he was just a great bunch of guys. And there was one guy named Ted Jackson, who was the youngest guy there, and he was like the teen idol as far as disc jockeys. And at the age of 14, he took me to the Johnson City Pavilion, and he said, tell your mother and father you're going to be coming home real late. And we got to the Johnson City Pavilion, and he was doing a big band remote, which you remember back then, from 11:30 to midnight. And I'm up on the side of the stage, and he's got his microphone stand and everything, and he said, you just stay here, we're going to have something special tonight. I said, oh, okay, I won't do that. And because I'd been around them and everything, and Gene Krupa's band was the group that was, well, was playing and dancing and everything. And half hour goes by, and end of the show comes up, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Gene Krupa, and this is Ted Jackson, your announcer. And he taps me on the shoulder, and I walk up to the mic, and I say, this is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company. And then, ding, ding, dong, that was it. From then on, nothing else.
You were 14 years old.
All right.
That's movie material.
Yeah, but the thing that's scary about it, well, the people in New York or here in Chicago that were transferred, I said, what in the heck are they doing up there?
Now, had your voice started changing at 14?
Yeah, I didn't have to, you know, it was just me. I had to sound like a puberty
kid.
Yeah.
What was your first rock and roll gig?
Oh, boy. You mean as far as on the air?
Yeah.
Well, I got 1950. I was in Louisiana, and we had a program called Jam and Jive, which the owner's son and program director did every day from 3:30 till 6:30. And it was the only place in central Louisiana that played all black music back then. And I did it on Saturdays, and they called me Daddy-O's substitute. it was great. I was playing Fats Domino before he had a hit, Joe Liggins and the Honey Drippers, Buddy Johnson, one of the great, great bands of the rhythm and blues era. And I had just was so enthralled with it because they would send me down to the Greystone Grill, which was the place for African-American music, and I would be the only Caucasian there, and I'd be standing on the stage, and it was great. Ruth Brown, who was, by the way, Ruth Brown is still appearing at the Bootleggers out in Las Vegas on Thursday nights.
Oh.
Wow.
But what a great thrill it was. And if I can, real quick, I'm getting on.
No, please.
Sure. But this, during one of my Saturday afternoons, I had a portion of the show which was sponsored by, I'll get to that in a minute. It was spirituals, 15 minutes of black spirituals. And so they had, instead of records, they asked me to bring in, or in the studio and put them on, the original Blind Boys from Alabama.
Oh, my God.
So I'm in the studio, and they're in there singing. And they did not have instruments, but they just kept time by slapping the sun. And I've never seen anything like more. All of a sudden, I see them looking down, and there's smoke coming out of one of the guy's pockets because he had those big kitchen matches, and they kept singing, did not miss a note, and I saw him pulling the matches out and throwing them on the floor, and they never missed a beat.
His pants are on fire. It's a great story.
And the best part of it was sponsored by, get this, the Progressive Funeral Home of Lower Third Street in Alexandria. if I can, real quickly.
You can do anything you want to do.
There are so many people. First of all, I know Ron the Beekeeper is listening tonight.
Yes.
I want to say Jim Peterick said to say hello to you and his wife Karen, Scott May, Larry Millis of the Ides of March. I must tell you, when I got fired at my second job here, after I left, every Christmas, he would send me a Christmas card, no matter where I was. The only guy in Chicago that remembered me all those years. And also, D.K. Davis, my buddy, is listening
right.
in. And a friend of mine who I talked to today, and he said he's going to be listening on the Internet, a very special guy, Charlie O'Donnell, who is the announcer on the Wheel of Fortune and was the original announcer on Dick Clark's American Bandstand.
Yes.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Charlie and I worked together at KRLA, and he's just probably one of the nicest guys in the whole wide world.
Well,
and
Charlie, we have to talk to you on the radio some night. I'd love to hear
love
some
to
of his stories. Yeah.
Yeah, Charlie is married to a very beautiful young lady who was in the new Christy Minstrel Singers.
Mm-hmm. Wow. See, it's going to be like this tonight,
yes.
because Dick's life is full of so many fascinating stories. Just before we take a break, you ever thought about writing a book? You really should.
During the break, I'm going to show you something, and you'll understand why I'm impressed you said that.
Oh, can I just
okay.
say, too, that if we don't do a shout-out to Ronnie Rice, he will pout.
Oh, no.
We have a mutual friend in Ronnie Rice. He, over the years, Ronnie keeps us up to date on what's going on in Dick Biondi's life and vice versa.
Well, then I can tell you this real quick.
Okay.
Have you? I told Ronnie yesterday, and I had to tell him, you know how you, Johnny, would look at what you call hunks with their six-pack abs? Ronnie has a keg.
And he's proud of it, too.
Yes, yes. Well, true story. On our 5,000th show, this was about a month or so ago, Ronnie's in the studio with us, and Jim Peterkin and a bunch of people, and Johnny had this great cake.
A big sheet cake that I had specially decorated for the night, and I was having my picture taken, and I lifted the cake and tilted
over
it.
Over in the corner over there.
And the cake just, it was in slow motion, Dick. It just slid off and went splat. And Ronnie didn't miss a beat. He grabbed his fork and he says, hey, you're not going to waste a perfectly good cake. And he got him a plate of cake.
Did he say it was the 10-second rule? It hasn't
been on the floor for 10 seconds.
It's interesting to note that last week he went to a Chinese restaurant up in his area.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to send out for more rice.
No, we can make fun of him, but Ronnie Rice never comes in here that he does not reflect on. He is the professional that he is today because of
you. Well, he is just one of
every time.
He's a great entertainer, and he and I do this because always talks about me being this. In fact, we cut a record, as you know, and we called ourselves Feast and Famine. And I'm famine.
Uh-huh.
We're going to take a break. More with Dick Biondi coming up. We're talking with Dick off
the air.
Because I mean, it's literally, you can pick a record out, and chances are Dick has a story about somebody involved with the record.
In fact, coming up after midnight, you're going to tell the story about this little group called the Beatles that you might have first played on the radio. You want to say hi to some of your fans?
Yeah, I want to mention quickly that two of the greatest guys around, Fred Winston, who is listening over at PIA, mm-hmm. Greg Brown, and myself, all three of us are saying, when are we going to go back to work?
Well, hi to Fred and Greg. And
and Fred is probably one of the most talented men I think I've ever worked with, and he loves you too, and he talks so much about you.
Fred and I had such great fun over at, we were both over at WLS in the 70s. In fact, if I can, very quick story, and I know this is going to sound corny, and I don't mean to embarrass you with it, but I'm going to bore you with it anyway. My first exposure to you, I remember so clearly. I was 17 years old, 1960, and I was out, I'd been cutting grass, and I'd turned on the radio, this portable radio we had, and there was this new radio station, WLS, and I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. Hey, they're playing music I like. But a lot of the announcers during the day, as good as they were, they sounded a little more adult-like. Then that night, I thought, well, I'm going to give the station a try again. And turn the station on again, and it's the first time I heard you, and I was absolutely hooked, because you were talking my, you were wild, you were crazy, you were talking my language, you were playing more rock and roll. Cut to years later, in 1973, when I was hired at WLS, and I swear, Dick, this is absolutely true. The first night that I was in that studio, I looked around and I thought, this is where Dick Biondi worked. Then, and I've told Johnny this story too, that night after I got off the air, I walked across the Michigan Avenue Bridge and just kind of looked back and said, I've made it to where Dick Biondi worked.
Thank you. I got to tell you, when you bring that up, that very first night that we were on the air, May 2nd, 1960, was Jim Dunbar, Ed Grennan, Mort Crowley, Gene Taylor, Sam Holman, and me. The next morning, they had a department head meeting, and they all sat down, and Gene Taylor told me because he was there. They all sat down in the conference room, and the sales manager got up before anybody said another word. What the devil do we got on from 9 to midnight? And Sam Holman, God bless him, Sam Holman said, let's just wait and see. And the greatest program director I think I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
Well, thank goodness for Sam. He had faith in you. And again, I find myself saying this a lot. You got to keep it in the perspective of the time. What was on the radio? That was a really different sound that people were getting out of their radio.
You went from the Prairie Farmer station to bang. Here's rock and roll.
It was like, okay.
Well, if you could have heard the phone calls, because before we went on the air, they had me out there at midnight testing mics or whatever, and I'm playing Don't Be Cruel, and the phone calls that were coming in, you know, and it was frightening, because I said, wow, somebody's going to do something to me. But and it was, we had WJJD, which is a daytimer,
right?
And Ernie Simon, Jim Lounsbery, Rest His Soul, and all of those guys. And we came in, and we just rocked. And the best part of it was, Sam Holman told all seven of us, go in the studio, don't lose the license, and have fun. That was it. And it worked. We didn't even know what we were doing.
There was no handbook that this is how you do it. Yeah.
I think, and if I'm not mistaken, the telegram I got in Buffalo, would you like to join us at WLS in Chicago? We will be paying you $375 a week. That's where we started.
Wow. Wow. And you've been at in Buffalo at...
KBW.
KBW, yeah. In fact, that's the... if you get the Cruisin' series of albums, that's where they've got a little bit of what you were doing there.
It was owned by the Churchills, and they owned a church right next to the station. And it was that's the call letters. We know the Bible well.
Oh, that's great trivia.
And the man that I replaced, they were not really full-time rock and roll until Dick Lawrence brought us in, but I replaced a guy that was a legend on the East Coast in Canada. His name was George Lorenz, the Hound Dog.
Yeah.
Probably the greatest rock jock. If he had had just the breaks that Alan Freed did, he would have been...
Yeah.
Because Alan Freed, of course, was doing his thing at that same time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Quick email here from John. He says, I feel like I'm reliving my childhood again when I used to take my transistor radio to bed with me and listen to Mr. Biondi underneath the covers. Now, 40-some-odd years later, I'm again listening to him, but the lights are on. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Let me say thanks, if I can, to Mary, I think it is, in Schaumburg.
Yes.
Also to Mickey Katz, who is listening in tonight.
And well, we're going to let you talk to these people, too. Okay?
Yeah.
You want to hang on there?
Yeah.
Because and we're going to sneak in some more emails. So everybody, hang on. We've got Dick Biondi in here. We've locked the doors. News Talk 720 WGN.
We are very privileged to be able to spend some time with a man who was the first disc jockey in the United States to play a Beatles record, Dick Biondi.
Thank you.
How did that happen?
Friday afternoon they brought, it was Thursday, but Friday it went on the playlist.
Mm-hmm.
Ewart Abner from VJ Records and Howard Bednow came up, and they gave me a copy of the record, because I always wanted to have them for my record ops. So it went on the list the next day, and Gene Taylor was doing the countdown, and then Bob Hale, and they neither one of them played it, and I said, I want to play it. And I did, and it was February of 1963, and it was just a great record, and it was fun. Who knew what was going to happen?
Yeah.
Then I got fired on May 2nd of 63, went out to L.A. At second night I was there, I played my copy of it. The phone rang, and the kids said, get that crap off the air and play the Beach Boys. That was their... really.
Wow.
And 1 year later, they owned L.A.
Yeah. And you were one of the disc jockeys that was emceeing the Hollywood Bowl concert, I believe?
Yeah. Bob Eubanks brought the Beatles in. Great story. He mortgaged his house to do it. And there was Casey Kasem, Dave Hall the afternoon, who was the West Coast fifth Beatle, Charlie O'Donnell, Bob Eubanks, and myself. And each of us went out and introduced one of the they had acts leading up. And I got to introduce the Circle. That was the group just before him. Mm-hmm. Dave Hall went out, and he had his horn, and he was out there, and we're all standing off to the side waiting to go out because Eubanks wanted us to say all at the same time, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles." That way nobody is going to introduce them. So we're standing there, and Dave Hall is out there going nuts. Blah, blah, blah. And I'm standing, all of a sudden I hear this voice from behind me, "Mr. Hall, would you get off the blanking stage so we can do our blanking show?" And I turn around, it's Paul McCartney, and he says, "He does go on, doesn't he?" So we all went out. We all said it the same, "Ladies and gentlemen," and we wanted to, if I can say this without getting into trouble, because if you know the West Coast, out in that time in the 60s on the West Coast, the kids used to say if they loved something, it was bitching.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to say the Beatles, and Eubanks said no. So we all just said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles." And then it was like the biggest lightning storm you ever saw. 17,000 flash bulbs going off in the bowl, and the hill on the side was with another 10 or 20,000. And you could not hear because it was so loud.
Oh,
what a night.
Boy,
I guess. I got shivers just hearing the story.
And before the show, before they had the act on, I was out in the back stage area, and I think, I'm trying to remember, if it was Judy Collins or Joan Baez. I'm standing with next to Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager.
Brian Epstein.
Yeah, and he's standing there. The Beatles are inside a little room, and this guy comes around and says, "Brian, Joan Baez wants to meet the boys." And Brian Epstein said, "Are you out of your mind? They're going on in 15 minutes. Tell her to go to..."
Wow.
I mean...
a little soap opera backstage.
Yeah,
there.
You know, I mean, because it was so...
Yeah.
People were going nuts. They brought them in a Brinks truck.
My God!
Wow. Dick, I'm going to compare you to another friend of ours. And again, I don't mean to embarrass you, but you and Les Paul have something very, very much in common.
We're both almost 100.
No, you have incredible memories.
Yes.
You really do.
I mean, I tease Steve about the fact that he doesn't know what we ate for supper yesterday.
No,
but he knows what the flip side, you know, the B side of a record was from 1962.
Well, it's the important stuff.
The important stuff. And you know, you've got the total recall of the day of the week.
Well, are you a pack rat? Do you keep
things? Oh, yeah. I've got a whole pod down in South Carolina it's been there since I came here in 83. I've got 3,000 pounds of 33 LPs, including the Beatles Butcher album and Freewheeling by Bob Dylan.
Oh,
wow.
I shouldn't have said that. Now somebody's going to go.
Do you ever go visit your stuff? You ever go to... It's just stored away.
Yeah, it's just... there's a lot of good stuff. There's a lot of... I'll tell you more.
Well, you know what? Just think about it. If you don't continue with this radio thing, you could sell stuff on eBay.
No,
you'd be a very wealthy man.
That's it. I don't want to sell stuff because that... it's like the medal that Bobby Darin sent me from the Vatican. And he was there and... he kept in touch wherever he went, mm-hmm. and he had the Pope bless a medal for me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what a great story.
Yeah.
Wow.
But there's a good story about Bobby we'll get to.
Okay. We love
and
Bobby.
And can I say, if I can, to Mickey Sachs, thank you. He's been holding on, too.
Hey, you know what? They don't mind holding.
Well,
they just want to say hi to Dick Biondi.
In fact, speaking of Mickey, hey, Mickey, how you doing, buddy?
Hi, Steve. How's Johnny? How you both doing?
Mickey, thanks for calling.
Hope everybody's healthy. Dick, I love you, man.
Love you, and I saw Jeannie at the Ides concert Saturday, and then, of course, we talked, but thank you very much.
She's listening now.
Thank you, Jeannie.
You know what? You talk about high energy. We say this so often with the Ides of March. When Jim Peterit walks out on stage, he just scares me to death, because it's like, okay, is he just going to implode all of a sudden?
And how he juggles all the things that he's doing.
Yeah.
We've got him coming in this Thursday night with his Pride of Lions group, and he's got so many things. He's doing music right now that is as good or better as stuff that he did back in the 60s.
Yeah. He's a tremendous talent, and the best part about Jim, he's such a honest guy. There's yeah. no baloney, no phony, yep. and he and his wife are like, if I can say this, we were his maid of honor and best man, my wife and I, a couple of weeks ago at the cathedral when they renewed their vows. Father Dan Mayall, and it was really nice. Oh. And the only part of it was I was very upset with Father Mayall.
Because?
Because he was doing this, you know, it was after the Mass, but he was blessing them and blessing the rings. But he never got to the point where he said, if anybody here knows any reason, then I want
Oh, no. I bet you Peterick said, be sure, Father, you don't go there because Biondi will say something.
Mickey, thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah,
can I, real quick, this
sure,
is
you can do anything.
With Bobby Darin. You brought up, I was doing record hops in Youngstown, and Bobby was coming into Cleveland and Youngstown because it was the hottest record-breaking area in the country. And my hops were averaging 1,500 to 2,000 a night. It was that big.
Wow.
Great. And I had one night, back then, you could not have a record hop just with records. You had to have a band play. So we had a three-piece band, Lenny, Mike, and Frank. Lenny Esposito was the drummer, and he was the guy that went on to manage the Kim Sisters in Las Vegas. But so they were all members also of Nick Burrill's band. Nick Burrill was a wonderful big band guy from the Youngstown area in the 30s and 40s. So every once in a while he would come in, and we had on this one Friday night Bobby Darin, George Hamilton IV, Frankie Avalon, the Ponytails, and I think that was it. So we had a rehearsal for Bobby because he wanted to sing, you know, live and not lip sync. And he brought in his charts with the Dick West had.
Yeah.
So he's going to do Mack the Knife.
Mm.
And a couple of others. They got to one part of a song and Nick could not, somehow he was a trumpet player, could not cut the music for some reason. So Lenny, the drummer, said, Nick, when we get to that part, just lay out. What, are you kidding? Well, we'll try one more time. They played it. He couldn't make it. He took the music. He threw it at Bobby Darin. I'm standing there. Landed it. Bobby said, you ain't nothing but a dumb rock and roller, and you'll never amount to anything. We were like, we didn't know what to do. So that night, which was, you know, a few hours later, when it came time for that song, thank God he laid out.
Wow!
What a story!
Yeah,
and it was a scary moment, but it and Bobby was just as nice. He never said a word. He just stood there and let it cool.
Wow! And you wonder if their paths ever crossed after that.
No.
Bobby Darin would say, "I'll have my people talk to you."
Yeah.
You know? Wow! Dick Biondi with us in the studio tonight.
Before we take a break, let me just, because this is long, long distance. Vicky's been hanging out in San Diego. Hey, Vicky, you're on with Dick Biondi.
Yumi Matsumaki, hello.
Hi, Vicky.
Hi, Vicky.
Hi, Vicky. How are you, darling?
Hello.
Vicky.
I'm calling to say hello, yes?
Weren't you with us in East Dundee at the Anvil Club?
That was me.
Yes.
What a memory.
I tell you.
Yeah, and you hadn't found a place to stay, if I remember. You had to go look for a motel. Did you get one?
Oh, yeah, everything worked out fine. Thank you for asking. What a memory. I can't hardly believe it.
You were very kind, because I remember you were there all evening. You came down when I was changing after it, and then we talked downstairs.
That's right.
Did you grow up in the area, Vicky? You grew up around here?
No, actually. I grew up in Cleveland.
Oh, so you were one of those...
That was my first visit to Chicago, believe it or not. It's really nice. The outskirts are really nice.
So you were a long-distance listener, too. I'm getting email from literally all over the country tonight from people who are listening long-distance.
Yes.
Well, Vicky, thank you, and I'm glad you got back safely, and please continue. And I'll be letting you know when we're back on the Internet, okay?
Perfect. And I also wanted to say, by the way, happy birthday just shy of 2 weeks ago.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anytime.
Thanks, Vicki.
God bless you, Vicki.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Let me read you an email that just came in. The email says, great show, Steve, Johnny, and Biondi. It has a certain ring to it. And isn't it tremendous that when you play back an old tape of Dick from 1960, his voice is exactly the same as it is today? He's the most unique talent in the history of rock radio. The only reason there aren't statues of him, movies about him, and books on his life is he's still around, thank the good Lord, and hopefully he'll be back in the game he loves soon. This is from Bob Surratt.
Oh, thank you, Bob. Bob is probably the reason I'm back in Chicago. Of course, not probably, he is. First of all, to Bob, my sympathy on the loss of his mom, which... Bob has been calling me, but unfortunately I was under a gag rule.
Right.
And I don't know if Bob was told that. And they said if I had said anything. But Bob came down to South Carolina. He is probably the best friend any radio personality has ever had.
Absolutely.
And I there should be a statue of him. And I mean it, because he's just... and he will not accept a compliment. He's somehow. But Bob, we love you, and thank God you're still with us. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Doing a fine job on that 4 o'clock news.
How cool is that?
I think you remember the picture of Dorian Gray, the aging picture up in the attic. That's Bob Surratt.
Oh, I know that.
It's like, okay, how does his hair get curlier? And
can I talk to Mary,
please? Sure. Let's talk to Mary.
Let's go to Mary in Schaumburg. Hey, Mary, you're on with Dick Biondi.
Hi.
Hey, Mary.
I tell you what, you know, Steve, Johnny, Dick is what Dick is. I can remember when I was in high school going to KRLA with my two little brothers. Dick, do you remember teaching them how to pitch pennies?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
I think they robbed you blind. I'm not too sure. And I tell you, you talked to Vicki in San Diego. I just got home from San Diego, turned on my radio, heard Steve and Johnny say that you were going to be on, and I thought... Got a call. I went to South Pasadena High School, and Dick had a wonderful program that he called the Dick Biondi Road Show. Took it to my high school. It was wonderful.
Which high school was that again, Mary?
South Pasadena High
School. Oh, yeah, because I worked in Pasadena, yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah. I went up to the Sheraton every night to stand on the steps.
You were one of the porch people.
I was one of the porch people. Absolutely.
You know, can I quickly explain,
please,
Mary?
Yeah.
Let me explain to you. At KRLA, we were at the Huntington Sheraton Hotel in one of their side buildings, and there was a porch led up into our studios. And I was on from 9 to midnight, and every night about 6:30, the kids would start coming. I'd sit out there and talk with them, and then I'd come out during records. And it was amazing how many wonderful, wonderful kids came out. And we became very tight, didn't we, Mary?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You kind of helped me raise my two brothers.
I was pretty good at the pitching pennies.
But I think they got better.
You know, you are story. So... And Mary, while you're on, let me, if I can, share a story about the porch people. And this is something you probably remember, too. There were so many wonderful people up there. But I used to work until midnight, and we'd say goodbye to the porch people, and we got to be... one morning after I'd gone home, I was in bed at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm asleep, and the door is... practically falling off. Somebody is banging on the door, and I get up and I go to the door, and it's a policeman. Mm-hmm. He says, "Are you Dick Biondi?" And I said, "Yes." "Get dressed. We need you immediately." I said, "Whoa." He said, "Don't worry. Just get dressed. Come with us." So I said, "Oh my God!" So I ran in, got dressed. I said, "What did I do wrong now?" So I go out and get in the back seat, and I said, "What?" He said, "Relax. There's nothing wrong. We just need you to help us." And I said, "Okay." So Mary, you're still with me?
I am.
He takes me to a hospital in L.A., and we go into the emergency room. He said, "We need you to identify somebody." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, there's a young girl here who is OD'd, and the only name she's mentioning is Dick Biondi.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And I walked into the emergency room, and I said, yeah, that's Judy from South Pasadena.
One of the porch kids.
Yeah. And they called the mother and father, thank God, and they got there. It was a scary thing, but the porch people were very, very special.
Wow. That's an incredible story.
Yeah, well, I tell you, Dick would do anything for anyone.
and Mary, the road show we did, Johnny and Steve are going to love this one. I had the road show, you know, Whittier High School.
Oh, yeah.
Whittier was a little different than South Pasadena.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Young Rascals were in town promoting. So they said, we'll do your road show. And they would play live and everything. Mm-hmm. So we get out there, and we're on stage. The curtain is down, of course, and the kids are plowing in. And all of a sudden, the show is delayed for 20 minutes because the teachers had to go out and get bobby pins from the girls to put up the Rascal's hair because it was too long for the principal of the high school at Whittier High School. And they had to put hats on them so they couldn't see the hair.
These would be bad examples for the kids.
Can you believe?
Well, those were pretty conservative times. I remember, even in public school, the girls from South Pasadena had to wear uniforms.
In public school?
In public school, yeah, because we lived between Alhambra, which was not so wealthy, and San Marino, which was extremely wealthy. And so we had to wear uniforms to school.
Now, Dick, when you left Chicago the first time, you went out there, right?
And you're talking about about the San Marino. She's bringing up I lived in Arcadia, so it was right past San Marino, and there was a liquor store called Flick's Liquor Store.
Oh my gosh, yes.
You remember that, Mary?
Oh yes.
Okay, Flick was of Lebanese descent, and I used to stop in there a lot of time, pick up whatever I needed, and one day I walked in, and there is Danny Thomas standing at the counter, and Flick says, hey, Dick, say hello to Danny Thomas. And I was like, oh, my, you know, what a, I shook his hand, and I'm standing there, and Flick said, okay, Danny, here, because what Danny Thomas did, he would go out and find out all over before he bought anything if there was a Lebanese person that had the business, and that's who he did business. So I'm standing there watching him, and he said, well, how much do I owe you? And Flick told him. Now, nosy me, I'm looking down, and he's got his checkbook out. I looked at it, and his balance was $60,000 in his checkbook.
Whoa.
Wow. Well, you know, in the South Pasadena area, there was a huge Lebanese population.
$60,000? I think...
And Mary, the area, the fun that we had with the guys like from Alhambra, the Midnighters, Cannibal and the Headhunters, which was the Barrio.
Wow, great stories, Mary. Thank you so much for calling.
It's so good to hear your voice again, and God bless.
You too, Mary, and thank you. You've made my night.
Thank you, Mary.
Thanks, love,
bye
Mary.
Bye now.
Bye bye.
Another email, if I can. This, and we're going to make you a copy of this one. Wanted to say hi to Dick from Megan Diamond. I was a promotions person for his live broadcast at 104.3, and sometimes his weather girl. I miss him dearly, and I'm so glad you guys have him on the radio right now, so we can all hear him again. Dick is an amazing broadcaster, and I look up to him. Most DJs who have their own show by themselves usually have help to answer the phones or emails or control things. Not Dick. He would be at the studio every night, late, by himself, doing everything, answering every email that he got, taking all the phone calls, and controlling his own show. And then she says some other things. She says, all your old promotions people want to organize a dinner so we can see you again. And she leaves phone numbers and things that we'll give you off the
thank
air.
You so much, Megan. She was a sweetheart. And she did so many wonderful things. For those kids that work, those promotion kids, are so great. It's like Katie, your girl.
Yeah.
And Megan, thank you. We love you. And thank you for being so nice.
Dale writes, he's of the Greaser Club. I'm a former oldies jock who broadcast an oldies show out in Morris, Illinois, in 1987, Dick Biondi was gracious enough not only to be on the air with me, but spent much more time than what was expected. As I started the interview, it was clear to me that I was speaking to a very giving and unselfish individual, and it remains one of my fondest memories. And that's Dale, quote, the Greaser Club.
Hey, Dale, thank you. You know, they were the greasers and the dupers. You
know? Boy, that's a flashback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dale, yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Dick Biondi with us in the studio here, Broadcast Hall of Famer. I got to ask you, though, you talk about doing a show from 9 to midnight. Did you ever encounter people who weren't savvy about the business and said, yeah, that Biondi works 3 hours a day, you know, walk in the park, what a job.
Well, most people would come and say, hey, what do you
do? What do you do for a living? Yeah, that's playing for 3 hours a day.
But I always accepted that as a compliment, and they didn't realize that we were doing, you know, at my last one here, I got there at 4:35 o'clock every day.
Yeah. But, doing prep for the show?
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. Well, I don't do prep. I mean, it happened. But yeah. it's fun, and I can understand people say, wow, just... And I always said, boy, am I lucky when I think of the people that are working 8, 9, 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
And look at the guys that, like the policemen and the firemen. My father was a fireman. And when you see what, especially after the firemen at 9/11, boy, 3 hours is nothing but it. I'm blessed.
Well, as we say, you know, sitting over behind a hot microphone, you know, big whoop. When we were out at Gough Mill back in the summertime, that really, really hot spell, and they're building a new movie theater out there.
And there are guys up on the roof.
Pouring tar. And it was 114
degrees. That's real work.
Night I came to work and sat in an air-conditioned studio, and I thought, wait a minute, I'm going to flap my jaw for 6 hours? This is a bad gig? Yeah. I don't think so.
No.
But you were practically working 7 days a week, because you were doing these sock hops and these appearances. And
speaking of the appearances, I just had a Dick Biondi flashback. I just realized you hosted the first rock and roll concert I ever saw. It was at the Civic Opera House.
And I'll tell you who was on it.
Okay.
Brooke Benton was the headliner.
Oh, right.
And I was the guy that walked out in the middle of Runaway and handed Del Shannon his kazoo because he would not hold it. He couldn't have anything in his pockets.
Oh, because his pants were too tight? Probably.
Okay, and let me see if I've got the rest of this right. The Jarmels, who came out tossing bars of soap, because that was their hit record. Mm-hmm. The Platters, Dee Clark.
Yep.
And I was sitting up in the balcony, and again, I don't mean to embarrass you, but all these groups were cool, but I was saying, that's Dick Biondi! How cool is that?
I guess who was standing backstage with me?
Who?
Ral Donner.
Really?
Yeah, I went to get, but I got to tell you, this, forgive me, you mentioned...
Your memory is scary.
You mentioned the Platters. This is, I'm working in Buffalo. The Platters had appeared that night at the big show venue there, and we were at the Coco Club, which was on the east side of Buffalo, and it was primarily a African-American club. Mm-hmm. But all of us guys, Lucky Pierre, myself, and the other jocks, would go over there, because we were in the business. So we go in there that night, and here they come, the Platters. And we're talking and everything, you know. So after a while, I went into the men's room. Now, even after 1958-59, I thought I was hit, but I had to be the dumbest guy in the world. I walk in, and there's Tony Williams. And I walk in, hey, want to take a little trip? Uh-huh. And he was... Guess what my reply was? No, I just got back from New York last week. I just forgot. I never felt.
I knew I loved you, Dick. Yes.
I love that Tony Williams got a lot of mileage out of that story.
He went outside, and when he told him, the whole place broke up.
No, I just got back from New York. That's Dick Biondi.
that's from the album that came out in, what year was it? 1963?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dick Biondi's favorites, The Teenagers, with Ray Stevens on piano. And
and then you left town after that was released, right?
Charlie McCoy is on that one.
Yeah.
And it's just I really want to tell her this, because you, Johnny, when I came back here in 1967, I was doing the All Night Show. Mm-hmm. And after the first month or so, every night at 1 o'clock, just about right on the button, the phone would ring, and I'd pick up the request line, and this woman would say, can you tell me what time it is? And she did this every single night. And I would say, it's 1 o'clock. Thank you for calling. Good night. And it kept on going and going. And finally, one night, I just said, please forgive me, but can I ask you a question? She said, yes. I said, you call me every night the same time, and it's always the same time. I said, why? And she said, I just want to hear a man's voice before I go to sleep.
Oh. Oh.
And it really hit me what, what you can do by just, you know.
Being there. Yeah. Wow, I got goosebumps.
That's, and again, I don't mean to embarrass you. And for those of you just joining us, because some people join us after 1 o'clock, we're fortunate enough to have Dick Biondi in the studio with us. One of the things that I've always loved about your approach, there was no barrier between you and the listeners. You were always talking one-on-one just to me on the other side of that radio speaker. And I love that.
Well, that when I was 14 years old, Ted Jackson at WINR in Binghamton sat me down and he said, Dick, first of all, if you're going to do a commercial, don't read the commercial. In your mind, visualize what you're reading. Mm-hmm. And just don't read the words. And then he said, and one more thing. When you get on the air, think of somebody that you know is listening, somebody that you know well.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to that person. And that means you're talking to everyone individually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just like you and Johnny.
Yeah. Actually, we laugh about the fact that we are actually very shy people. When you know, you don't want to invite us to parties.
Hey, get us out in public at a party. And we're the wallflowers over the corner.
I got to tell you this story because I know what you're going to. This back in 1957, I had the pleasure of talking to Sam Phillips in Nashville, who I had known. Mm-hmm. And I asked if he could get me because I had made a promise that if I had a hop and got 2,000 kids, mm-hmm. I'd sit on a flagpole for 3 days and three nights. So he said, Dick, I can't get you, Orbison. He said, but I got, mm-hmm. I got a kid that's got a hop record. And it was hot. For $150, he sent Jerry Lee Lewis up to Youngstown, Ohio.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, this is the first time he ever came north. Mm-hmm. I brought him up 2 days before. I got Lenny, Mike, and Frank, the thrill, to play for back him up because mm-hmm. he was going to play the piano. And we had a rehearsal, and everything was great. And the night before the hop, I get a call from my friend in New York. He said, Dick, you got a hop tomorrow night? I said, yep. I'm going to be coming through. I got a kid that I want to bring out. I said, but I got Jerry Lee Lewis. Well, I'll just let him lip sync his record before Lewis goes on. So I said, okay. So here comes the night, next night, 2,000 and some kids. And my mother and father were there. I could not believe it. They saw this. Mm-hmm. So I'm playing records for a while, and then here comes my friend Woody from New York. He says, say hello to Mike. And I said, hi, Mike. And I knew I was in trouble. He said, here's the record. Give it to your guy. So I give it to the guy. I said, play this side when he gets up there. The kid that came out was Michael Landon. Now, Michael Landon had just finished I Was a Teenage Werewolf.
Yeah.
And when he walked on that stage, the girls went nuts. They were, you know.
Oh,
how?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, he was gorgeous.
Oh, he was.
Yeah.
So he does, give me a little kiss, will you, huh? And he couldn't sing, really, but he lip-synced it, and they went nuts.
Oh.
Now I had to bring Jerry Lee Lewis out. Lewis came out, and he did his, we had two shows because there's so many. He did, I think, 10 or 12 songs, and he was great. He did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He walked off the stage as I'm walking up to bring him off. He put me on first, next.
Oh.
So I said, okay. So we move along. Here comes the next set. I bring him up, Jerry Lee. He does 14 songs without stopping. He just one after the other. Walks off, leaving a trail of sweat. And he walks by Michael Landon. He says, go up there and top that, pretty boy. Now, the night before the dance, I had a little cookout behind my my house, and Jerry Lee was there. And we're sitting talking, and since I worked in Louisiana and did football broadcasts in his high school, Faraday, mm-hmm. we're talking, and I knew he was a Baptist, of course. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, Jerry, you know, just for, I said, are you a real Christian? Now, what a dumb thing for me to say, but I asked him, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, let me tell you something, Dick, and this is gospel word for word. Let me tell you something, Dick. If I were a real Christian, tomorrow night, instead of me going on that stage and shaking my behind all over, mm-hmm. I'd walk up there with a Bible and tell these kids what's up. I never forgot that.
Yeah. Wow.
And of all the guys in rock and roll that we thought would not be alive, he's still around.
We said that last night, Dick. Is that so funny? Because his new album, which comes out today, Tuesday, is Last Man Standing, because that goes back to his days at Sun Records.
And when you look at that list of people, Elvis, Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, Charlie Rich.
They're all gone.
And you'd say, okay, who do you think is going to self-destruct first? Jerry Lee Lewis would have been the first name on the list.
Yeah, he's on his seventh life, though.
Yeah.
But he's got two more.
Remember, he shot his bass player in the chest.
Yeah.
God. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy stuff.
We want to jump back to the phone calls and some people listening to us long distance. And, Ben, you're calling us from Hawaii?
I sure am.
Hi, Ben.
Aloha to you.
How's everything in Hawaii?
Everything is just wonderful.
Now,
thank you.
Your name is Bill Christie? Ben Christie?
Ben Christ, that's right.
And you are...
used to own the U.S. 30 drag strip?
Yes, I was the owner of U.S. 30 drag strip.
Sunday!
Got it. And I was an acquaintance of Dick Biondi even before that, when we had our first racetrack in Ohio. And Dick was gracious enough to help us get started. And, of course, he always had an enormous following in our age range.
Well, boy, Ben, I tell you something. I'll never forget that U.S. 30 drag strip. One thing that I think you knew about, we had go-kart races down there one Sunday. You remember?
Yes.
And the guys that figured they were going to have a little fun with me,
mm-hmm.
and they loosened the back wheels on my go-kart so I would wobble all the way down.
Oh,
oops.
My gosh. Well, it's funny talking to Dick Biondi, the legendary Dick Biondi, Ben. I have to say, it must be pretty cool to be a part of pop culture history yourself, because anyone who grew up around here knows Sunday.
I mean, well, it got to be, for a while, a greeting around Chicago.
Yeah.
I used to go to the tennis courts, and people who were in were out of the age range of the drag racing at that time
mm-hmm.
used to greet me that way all the time.
And even to today, you know the age of people when you say U.S. 30 drag strip.
Jan Gabriel was the guy that did that.
I was just going to say, Jan Gabriel, who we've had on the show many times, still in the car business.
Yes.
And started out in radio with Steve 100 years ago.
Yes.
And so you live in Hawaii now.
We do live in Hawaii.
So drag racing was very, very good to you.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. And during that time, of course, it was an introductory sport.
Uh-huh.
And we were not received with open arms. But young people are always on the progressive end of things. And they were on the progressive cutting edge of drag racing, which has become an enormous sport.
I bet back then there was some fear that it was going to be like Rebel Without a Cause. You know,
that's exactly right.
You were the wild one if you were drag racing.
That's right, and we were very fortunate to have people like Dick supporting the sport,
uh-huh.
and I'm sure his influence was very instrumental in our success.
Well, thank goodness we have the internet, so you can be listening tonight, Ben.
Thank you, Ben. That is so kind of you to call, and more importantly, what a compliment that is that you even remember of all the guys. Are you living on the Big Island, or?
No, we live on Oahu in Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever go over to Maui?
Yes, we do go occasionally.
When you do the next time, say hello to Elvis.
Okay, I'll do that.
Ben, nice to meet you.
Hey, Ben.
Thank you so much for letting me hear Dick and hear you all. We're very
Thank
grateful
you.
Here.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you.
Aloha
and
to you.
Aloha.
Aloha, Ben.
Thanks a bunch. Yeah, that's one of the fun things with the internet. You never know where people are listening to you.
Yeah.
And we're getting so many emails from all over the place.
I can't tell you the number of emails we got from people who say, it was my first transistor radio, and this was the first voice that I heard on my first transistor radio there in the bedroom, under the covers.
Let me take you back, if I can, to one of your signature bits back in the days at WLS, on top of a pizza. How did that all come about?
It just started off with the kids. I don't know. I somehow said something, and they started helping me with the lyrics. And it just and then Don Carone recorded it with us at IRC Records up on the north side.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years later, John Paul Glazer and his group changed a couple of words and had a smash with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although we did sell 11,000, if you send in 50 cents and I think it was two or three Pepsi caps.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And if I recall, I think you got, wasn't it a picture slipcover with the two of you?
Yeah. This is really frightening because a couple of years back, some lady came to Brother Rice. I was doing a record hop, and she had one of those.
Uh-huh.
She said, could you autograph this, please? And I did. The record, too. I said, okay. 2 weeks later, she calls me up and said, I just want to thank you. You know that record you autographed? I sold it on eBay for $155.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was using them as frisbees.
See, I told you that eBay thing could do very, very well for you. Quickly, I want to just say Mary Sauer says, hello, Dick. She's just so happy to be able to hear you tonight. A few years ago, she saw you on stage at the Sandwich Fair in Sandwich, Illinois.
Oh, boy.
And, then we had Jim emails and said last time he saw you was at the Harley Davidson gig.
Yeah.
Where you were doing an appearance. Scott McKenzie, writing from Wisconsin, a former Chicagoan who listened to you on LS and CFL, just wanted to say he misses you. And you're truly a Chicago history book for rock and roll, from the Wall of Sound by Phil Spector to Chicago's very own Crying Shames, and looks forward to hearing you somehow, somewhere.
Thank you. And by the way, speaking of the Sandwich Fair, boy, those Kay's pork chops are great. Oh, my goodness, I love those.
They rule. You are so right.
You know, you mentioned Rebel Without a Cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're bringing stories up.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Youngstown and doing hops, I did a bit where I had a full face beard.
Mm-hmm.
And I dyed it school colors every week. This is no lie. Don Rose was a beautician. Well, come on.
That could be hideous.
All right, this is for real. I got
blue and gold.
I got pictures. Every Thursday night, Don, he was a beautician, would bleach it out completely, and then he would put in, like there was red and white, orange and black, and all, you know, until we got to the new Catholic high school, Ursuline High School, whose colors were gold and green.
Uh-huh.
Now, during this time, when they were doing it, it was Saul Rabinowitz, who was the national promotion man for Epic Records, came in and he said, what a great deal. He said, tell you what, I'm promoting a new record. If I can get you to go to New York and have the singer make believe he's dyeing your beard, you know.
Uh-huh.
Would you do it? I said, yes. So 2 weeks later, I had Don bleach it out completely. I went on a Monday, went to New York, and went up to this house where the owner made caskets in a cellar. And his son had a little, like, toothbrush with some stuff and was putting on the black.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Sal Mineo, the guy that was in Rebel Without a Cause.
Oh, my gosh. Boy.
And it was great. We made all the trade papers. But I got back, and we had to get rid of that. And now comes Ursuline High School. At that time, there was no dye for women's hair or anybody's hair green. But I didn't want to let them down. And I put green enamel paint in there.
Ooh.
Because you had to have it. And it was great until I tried to get it out. And I wound up at the emergency room because my face was starting to peel.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was a great bit.
Oh, my God. Just anything for the fans.
It was great, but it was, you know, and I'd wear the matching clothes.
Yeah.
But who knew that green
paint?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it would come right out, you know, because what I did, I actually got turpentine and tried to do it like, you know, you thin it out, and that's what killed the skin.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, we're talking about all the stunts you've done, whether it's that kind of thing, flagpole singing, whatever. Because you've always been so willing to do these things. Was there ever a point when you said, wait a minute, what have I just gotten myself into?
Or, no, I won't do that.
No. Two things that I did, and I would like it, we have the time. One,
sure.
The first one, when I was in L.A. in 1965, I was at the Hollywood Palladium for the Teenage Fair, which ran 9 days.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous. I was in a cage with a little chimp called Goldfinger. Now, this is... And we you're laughing. So I had to spend 9 days in there, and we had a typewriter, until he typed KRLA, the call letters. You remember... Now, you remember, given enough time, a monkey could...
Yep.
Okay, so... And we would walk him over and try to... He never did it. But his trainer was one of the Barrymore family and a nice guy. And we met and everything was set up. And he said, Dick, I'm going to tell you one little thing. Goldfinger weighed 130 pounds. Great little cute chimp. Had pants, diapers, all, you know. But anyway, he said, this is... listen to this. The third day before it was over, and he told me to begin. He said, Dick, if, and it may happen, he's going to try to bite you. He said, he doesn't realize it, but he's going to. And he said, if he does, freeze. Don't move a muscle, because if you move, you'll rip your skin or tear it apart.
Uh-huh.
So I said, yeah, right. So now we got the afternoon of that day. I remember it. I'm sitting there. And I reach out, because the kids are all around. And he sinks his teeth right here in the web between the thumb. And the guy yells, freeze! And I held my hand still. This chimp opened his mouth and started backing up. And I had to do something that he told me to do.
Mm-hmm.
I got my hand bleeding, made a fist, and whacked him up under the chin as hard as I could. And I got booed, and everybody started screaming at me and telling me what a rotten... Now, listen, this chimp goes into the corner and is crying. And here comes the guy, puts alcohol and everything on it. And all of a sudden, the kids are still very upset that I whacked them. Here comes the chimp, comes up, puts his arms around me, and kisses me on the cheek.
Oh, my gosh. He couldn't type, but he could play the audience real well.
It was great.
There's a little behind-the-scenes thing. A lot of people don't know, but for a long time, when Dick was over on JMK, we'd be driving in, we'd be listening to Dick Biondi as we're coming in, and then when we'd get on, we have Ronnie Rice or somebody on with us, and we get messages from Dick. So we had this sort of a listening to each other relationship going on.
I remember the night that Bob Hale was leading the radio station, and Bob was listening in, and we were talking about the anniversary of...
Buddy Holly's death.
Yeah, that's right, the plane crash that killed Buddy Holly. And Bob Hale tells the story that he made a U-turn in the middle of Michigan Avenue and came back and says, let me on the radio! They need to talk to me! He's one of the all-time nice guys.
Nice,
too.
Yeah.
He really is.
Yeah,
we were talking too about great interviews. In fact, I'll just tell our listeners that this conversation continues off the air during the commercial breaks. Tell our listeners about one of your all-time favorite interviews, because I think they might be surprised.
Yeah, let me just mention this, because you're talking about you don't have any restrictions. Over at the last place I worked, I had a program director in the 90s. I went into his office one day and I said, hey, I can get Chuck Berry tomorrow night for an interview. He said, good, don't go over 5 minutes. That's a true story. Anyway, get back to the one of my best favorite interviews was Liberace, who, first of all, made a friend out of me when he walked in with the promotion man who said, Dick, this is Liberace. I know you want to do an interview, but let's hurry it up because we are. And Liberace, wait a minute. He looked at the guy and said, do me a favor. Go sit in the lobby, and when I'm through, I'll come and get you. Whoa. Guy was like, so he came in, he sat down, and it was, I had the show called Dick Biondi and Friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave an interview, talked about drugs, talked about rock and roll, talked about everything, and it was one of the best ever.
You just felt it was happening.
Yeah, it was. We did an interview with Chicago that we got three shows out of, and Dick Biondi and Friend was an hour show. We got three.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, they were
great.
Wow.
With all the stuff that you've got, let me give you a weird hypothetical. With all of the things you've got, records, pictures, memorabilia, whatever, hypothetically, your house is burning, you can only grab one thing.
Very easy.
Okay.
Pictures.
Okay.
Because pictures you can't ever get again of people who are no longer. My father, my mother, a picture of us together here in the studio. And in fact, it's been documented that 99% of the people who were in Auschwitz or who escaped and had to leave said that was the one thing they missed most of all, was the photos.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, what's the most, with all of the people that you've encountered, from Elton John, the Beatles, whoever, is there one person that you knew you were going to have to interview that you were really nervous about?
A couple, yeah. One was Peggy Lee, which I interviewed at the Palmer House.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, which I was nervous about, only for a few seconds, but I was working at Mutual Network in New York, and we had 125 stations around the country carrying us. But I'm sitting in there, and all of a sudden, I see this crowd of people. And I look up, and there's Muhammad Ali. And he said to the person, what's going on? He said, that's Dick Biondi's doing a disc jockey show. So he walks in, and he says, hi, I'm the champ. Very soft-spoken.
Uh-huh.
And he said, can I sit down and talk to you? And I said, yeah. What? It so happened that it was 2 weeks after Sam Cooke was shot to death out in Los Angeles. He sat down and did a soliloquy about Sam Cooke you would not believe.
Oh,
it was just beautiful. And I didn't have to say a word. And he was just all right by himself. What a great... Wow. I was so nervous when he walked in because I didn't... And he just made you feel right at home.
Now, you've got that on tape.
Somewhere it's on tape.
Yeah. It sounds like Steve. Somewhere it's on tape.
Yeah, but you know, one of the things that... I never really thought it was important to have a tape because I didn't realize what we were doing.
We were just living in the moment, not thinking about this was history that you were making.
But with all the stuff you've done, you ever been scared, whether it's an appearance and there are just so many people or you know, something where you think, okay, this could get out of control. I'm a little concerned about this.
No, I did the thing for Marty Faye at Tillman Stadium, his softball thing, and they put me in the cage because, there was kids asking for autographs. They got, I think they overreacted, but...
Put you in a cage?
Yeah. where they sell the tickets to get in?
Right. Yeah. To protect you from the fans.
But you're asking a serious question. I have something the one thing that I think that really inside that is so important to me of all the things that have happened... 1962, I'm over at Ellis. I'm on the air, and it's one of those late summer nights where it was probably one of the most beautiful sunsets I think I've ever seen. And we were, at that time, worried about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was coming up. And on the air, I said, hey, go look at that sunset. It's probably the most beautiful sunset you'll ever see. And if that doesn't prove that God's going to make everything all right, then there's something wrong. And I said it with the Cuban. A week later, I get a letter from a lady in Michigan. And she's saying, I don't know how to thank you. She said, and then she starts to explain, her husband was arrested and charged with burning down a building in a Michigan city and was facing 40 years sentence. And he didn't do it, but nobody knew. So she had taken a gun and was going to shoot her three kids and herself. And she said, when you said that, I just went to the window and I looked and I sat there for a moment, and she said, well, maybe I'll wait till tomorrow. She put the gun down, called her pastor. The pastor came over and talked to her, and he wrote to me and told me that this is a true story. And 2 weeks later, they found the guy that actually burned the building down and released her husband. And she could not write enough thank yous. But again, we're getting back to, we don't know, we on the radio, what our voices can do. And to me, how much better than you're saving four or five lives?
Yeah. Well, if you never did another thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I say thank you, God, for letting my words reach, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, speaking of your words reaching and the fact that her husband was in jail, with the time of day that you were on, I would imagine that you had people, guys in particular, listening to you from jail.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and they would write to you.
This is a true story. It's on the album. You've heard it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about when I was going out to do a thing, and this guy wrote me from the teenage reformatory.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'll try to stop by. And we went out there. I did what I had to do at the other place, and I went over, and the guys let me walk in and meet the kids.
This was out in San Salmonog, Sandwich, someplace out west there.
Yeah,
yeah.
Towards Dixon and that area. And so I went in, and they all laughed at the crazy Italian. And I said, thanks. And I said, I'll be talking about you on the air on Monday night, blah, blah. And I turned around to walk out, and the guy that had written to me was from Chicago, and he turned around to the guys. I heard him, and I was walking, and he said, see, I told you he'd show up, and you can't buy that.
And they were just teenage boys. Yeah. And as you said, you became aware of just how cut off they were from everything in the world outside of those walls.
They hear that voice is coming through.
Yeah, amazing. Because I know some of the mail that we've gotten over the years from Joliet in particular. they'd write as though you're family, you know?
But we were talking off the air with Dick about you've worked a lot of different markets, but there really is a uniqueness to the Chicago market, isn't
it? Amen. Let me first of all, and I hope everybody that's listening to WGN right now will listen to what I'm about to say, because it's from the heart. This station proves what every disc jockey in the United States, I think, feels. Here's a station that has Steve and Johnny, who are number one in their time slot, and the bosses upstairs say, okay, you're number one, do your thing. We're not going to bring some guy from New York or LA in here to decide how to run our radio station. And in this town, Chicago is a local town. And if only people would realize that they want to hear what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have, with all due respect, you can't have somebody from New York going on the air and saying, well, I'm going to play the vehicle song by the Ides of March, and this is the only hit they ever had.
Mm-hmm.
You know what you do to your audience, if it's possible for you, as you've done with me, hey, we're going to have Dick Biondi on the air. What a nice thing to be able to do, or talk about anything that's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And if the people would listen, and it's like, I say this and I get in trouble with it, but it's like me coming into your house, you, Steve, and Johnny, and saying, listen, here's the way you should run your house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never been in there before and probably won't be in again.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that. And there are a lot of broadcasters right now going, yes,
yeah,
you are so right. Well, we share some of the same friends, and it's just so, as Steve has said tonight, it's just so funny for us to talk on and off the air about people that we both know professionally and as friends. And there's one guy, and I actually remember listening to your show you were broadcasting from Graceland not too many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Saturday afternoon we were listening, and we went, oh, it's our buddy stopping by to visit with Biondi down at Graceland.
Hey, Hayden.
You know, now Hayden Thompson is so great. Do you realize he still draws thousands of people in Europe?
Well, he's on the radio right now.
In fact, he's on the phone with us right now.
Oh, he is?
Hey, Hayden, how you doing, buddy?
Good morning. Good morning.
Hi, Hayden.
You know what? I had such a high opinion of Dick Biondi until I heard the chimp story. anybody will hit a monkey. I don't know if I want him playing my music or not.
Oh, boy, that hurt. You don't know how it hurt that time with all those kids yelling at me, Hayden.
Buddy, it's so nice to hear you on with two of my favorite people, and it makes three on the same studio, and oh, it's so great. I've enjoyed this so much.
Well, thank you. I still love the Chicago River Blues.
Oh, I know you do.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that this man was down with his Fairlane song, and you were there when all of the guys, we were talking off the air about Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, being the only one left out of all the ones that we thought he'd be the first to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I even thought that myself. You know, I just received a nice magazine from London from called Now Dig This.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry just did three shows over there, and probably three of the best reviews. He usually plays, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, whatever he feels like.
Mm-hmm.
But they said he went almost an hour and did three terrific shows leading up to this new CD as coming out. And believe me, they love him in Europe. They love mm-hmm. him in Europe. What a
well,
great talent.
As Dick said, though, your career just blows us away. There's a movie in your career. We just talked to you from Japan the first time you played Japan a
How
couple weeks
that?
Ago.
How about that?
That was a thrill.
Had a great time. And, Dick, it's so nice to hear you on here with Steve and Johnny and all these stories. My goodness, you've been such a dear friend.
Well, and you have, too. And, you know, if only all the people in this town could get to see you work. You know, like myself and like Steve and Johnny, we're not teenagers anymore, but you still have, but Hayden has still got that wonderful, wonderful talent, and when he sings, it's just great.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, buddy, I'm waiting to hear you on another station here in the city, because we don't want you to leave Chicago.
Amen.
I don't want to leave.
You know, you can't leave Chicago on us, because we all love you, and just want to wish you the best.
Tell Georgia we send our love, and Hayden, let's get together and have a Coca-Cola one day.
Listen, and from all the rockabillies, plus that heavyset guy, Ronnie Rice, we say thank you very much for your support all these years, and all the best to you, buddy.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You, Hayden. Good Bye-bye. Night, now.
God bless you. He's a great
sweetheart. He really is. And I remember that Saturday afternoon, we flipped on the radio and said, man, you know, there's Biondi down in Graceland broadcasting for this big anniversary. And they were falling all over you down in Graceland.
Well,
and then you every year, I know, like us, you play Hayden Songboy from Tupelo, which is a fabulous song about a young Elvis Presley.
What a great man this guy is. If you listen to his old songs, when I say from, he still sounds the same.
I think he sounds better, though. His voice is richer.